Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
the sleeping sickness epidemic of the early 1900s.
What was the sleeping sickness epidemic? It was a medical enigma that swept across the world from 1916 to 1927 and came to be known as encephalitis lethargica. Patients suffering from this illness displayed a wide array of differing symptoms while trapped in a catatonic state with no rhyme or reason as to when they would wake up, if ever. Some recovered within weeks, some died in this state, and others still spent upwards of four decades asleep until a new experimental drug was able to wake them in one summer in the late 1960s.
Act 1. Suspended in sleep. Perhaps no aspect of human existence is as familiar yet enigmatic as sleep. We surrender ourselves to unconsciousness on a daily basis, relinquishing control over our minds in order to enter a realm of rest. A necessary transaction, an intrinsic part of life, yet some of the most profound things we can experience occur during sleep. Reality becomes malleable and time takes on a new dimension. The full range of human emotions are made available to us and can change on a whim. Unfettered joy, heart-wrenching nostalgia, and horrors beyond comprehension, all of which can leave us dazed upon the realization that what just occurred was merely a dream. Or, just as often, we wake up devoid of memory of the previous 8 hours. Sleep has confounded humans presumably for as long as we've been able to think critically about it. Many cultures regard sleep as being heavily associated with a connection to the spiritual realm or higher level of consciousness. Surrealist artists use sleep in the unconscious mind in hopes of revealing something more profound than lived experiences. And to this day, studies of sleep continue to serve as a window into the intricate workings of the brain. In the late months of 1916, Dr. Konstantin von Economo of the Psychiatric Neurological Clinic of the University of Vienna began noticing a strange pattern. Patients admitted to the hospital and a variety of symptoms and ill-fitting diagnosis all shared a single common factor, an extreme and debilitating lethargy. These patients' illnesses typically began with vague flu-like symptoms, headaches, fevers, vertigo, and slowed reaction times. However, they eventually began to sleep for abnormal lengths of time, if not indefinitely. Patients were soon getting stuck in a state of sleepy delirium for weeks on end. Many could be woken and even spoken to for short moments, though they physically could not fight the urge to fall back asleep. Under further investigation, these patients were also found to have strange abnormalities in their movement and motor skills. Twitches, tics, and strange eye movements were all common. Most interestingly, if a patient's arm or leg were to be lifted by a healthcare worker, their bodies would hold the position, frozen and suspended in place. Eleanor Carey, a survivor of the sickness, recorded her experience during this phase, stating,
"After 2 months of the illness, I was in little pain. In fact, it was so heavenly just to be allowed to sleep, but these people around me seemed determined to prevent me from being comfortable."
Carey continued on to explain that even after coming to the mental realization that she indeed should try to wake up eventually, she found herself completely unable to exercise this will. Other victims were not so lucky to have such a relatively smooth experience with the illness. such as a woman who was documented as having experienced a sudden paralysis across half of her body while walking home. Within 30 minutes, she had fallen into a prolonged bout of sleep, and within 2 weeks, she was dead. Yeah, so this is like a medical film from 1925 talking about acute encephalitis lethargica. That's like a medical video, but it's literally done in the way that you would imagine like a silent film from the 1920s where it has like the text and then it shows the video. So we'll kind of talk through this.
This is great podcasting. Just great podcasting. The patient showed almost complete anesthesia of the right side, which lasted 4 weeks. Also ataxia, disturbance of equilibrium, and a tendency to fall over to the right side. That's a big title card that says that. Now we're watching footage of this young woman who's being held. And she's kind of in a strange sleep, semi-conscious state. In the 8th week, the patient began to grow somnolent.
A doctor or somebody is just holding her up and she's just asleep. And they're kind of standing her upright and no matter what they do, she doesn't wake up. The patient is completely oriented and ready to react rationally to any command. Yeah, so she's like asleep, but she can actually, I guess, hear and interact with things happening around her because she's sitting there asleep, but she can be told to like touch her nose and she actually lifts her hand up and touches her nose. So she's like somewhat aware of her surroundings. Whilst performing the finger to nose test, the patient goes to sleep. As they're doing this little test, she just completely drifts off into sleep. So she's like in and out of consciousness, kind of in a catatonic state, able to kind of respond to commands and requests, but just basically unconscious. So Dave, before we move on with the story, I guess a couple of things. Number one is, had you heard of this story before? What was your familiarity with the story? And also, what's your relationship with sleep?
Is this a different medical disorder than the one that the Robert De Niro, Robin Williams movie is about? But the guy in the coma?
That movie was based off of this.
I guess I'm familiar with it because I've seen that movie. But I wouldn't say that I'm familiar with it other than I watched that movie. And I'm like, yeah, Robert De Niro, he was a sleepy guy. I'm pretty sure that's what that movie was called, right?
One of the Sleepy Guys?
Yeah, it's called Just One of the Sleepy Guys. And it's like Robert De Niro in like an old school like Ebenezer Scrooge style sleeping hat and nightgown, but he's making his, you know, frowny face, you know, Robert De Niro expression, but he's like holding a teddy bear. And the catchphrase from the trailer, I think, was him turning to Robin Williams and being like, hey, I'm just a really sleepy guy.
Yeah, Just One of the Sleepy Guys was actually a direct sequel to that movie from the 80s, Just One of the Guys, about that high schooler who starts dressing like a guy and she goes to a different school and poses as a guy.
Yeah, that's also tied into the like NBC mob show from the 80s called Wise Guys, right? It was part of the cinematic guy universe, the CGU.
That was actually the first cinematic universe that we got to enjoy. And honestly, much better than the MCU, I would say.
Yeah, the Gaiaverse was real something.
It was just guys being guys.
Yeah, it was just guys being guys. I wouldn't say that I'm familiar with this story in a particularly granular level of detail other than I'm like, you know, I'm dimly aware that it existed and I watched the movie that was eventually created based off of the traumatic experiences of one of the patients.
Before you answer the second, that's a pretty good or apt response because as we'll get into, that's kind of the point of the story, or not the point of the story, but that's a large factor of the story. This thing happened. It's an unexplained phenomenon that to this day, nobody fully knows why this happened. And it really hasn't happened at this scale since at all. It was just this period from 1917 to 1926 where all these people just basically fell asleep and a million people died, which is a massive amount of people. Like if something, aside from the fact that COVID just happened and millions of people did die, but if something happened now where a million people died, that would be a huge event. I mean, 9/11, like quote unquote, only 3,000 people died. And that still is part of our culture to this day. It's still in our cultural memory. But the thing was, as we'll get into, it happened alongside the Spanish flu, which has been covered on the show before. Shout out to our boy Woodrow Wilson, where 32 million people died. So it kind of like fell by the wayside. People were like, I don't give a fuck about your sleepy dead people. Like there's some shit going on here. So this thing that was number one, pretty massive, maybe not at the scale of the Spanish flu, but a pretty massive event. And also kind of fucking crazy. Like, it's actually more novel than the Spanish flu was in terms of like what happened, but it just completely got glossed over in history because it happened alongside the Spanish flu. So you and most people just having no idea what this is, aside from that movie that was made, is pretty emblematic of the fact that it was totally overshadowed by the epidemic that happened in 1918. But anyway, that being said, what is your relationship with sleep?
I wish I slept more. Cartoonists don't sleep enough. We die young. And yet, I gotta get shit done, broski. But also, I think I'm better about it now than I used to be. I make an effort to try and get a good amount of sleep now. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, everything you just said, except for that last part. Which is why I asked you, because this is an interesting story about a medical phenomenon that happened in the early 1920s. But I also think that there's like a bigger thing of discussing like people's relationship with sleep and the way that we interact with the phenomenon of sleep. Because, you know, as we'll get into as the story develops, you have these people that have this very interesting relationship with sleep where, you know, they're not in a coma. They're just asleep and they don't want to wake up. They're just like medically tired and they just slept for years. And I find that very interesting because I find myself in this constant deficit of sleep and this constant like mathematical wrestling match with sleep where it's like, I got this thing to do. I got this thing to do. I got to finish this. Like, I'm still trying to get this fucking narrative episode out that was supposed to come out last week that will come out before this episode that you're listening to right now. But as of this recording, it has not released yet, even though it was supposed to release like 4 days ago. And I'm fighting against time to get that done and all these other things. And then I ended up finding myself, you know, just counting calories. I'm counting like hours of like, oh, if I stay up till this time, I'll be able to wake up at this time tomorrow without it being too bad. And I'll be able to catch up with that sleep later on because I don't have to wake up early the next day. And I'm constantly in this mathematical number crunching of sleep and always just not quite sleeping the amount my body wants to. And so I have a unique relationship with like reading and talking about this story where it's almost kind of like an absolute nightmare to me. The idea, like, I already am in an existential war with my level of tiredness. The fact that like my body fails me eventually when I'm trying to push through and get things done. And the idea that you would be so chronically tired that you couldn't stay awake and then you would just drift off to sleep and then stay asleep for years is just like an existential nightmare to me.
Yeah, me too. But then again, there's just another part of me that's like, well, I wouldn't know. It's the same as dying. I think that the horror of that is like waking up in 30 years with your entire life having gone by. Waking up would be the worst. If that's how you die, okay, like it's a tragedy, young person dying like this, it's, you know, whatever. Like, that sucks. It's terrible. Getting I'm a sleepy guide, that's the real nightmare.
Yeah, you've perfectly hit the nail on the head because that's the discussion point that I wanted to open up as we go through the story, because we're going to go back to that and we're going to talk a lot more about what you're talking about, I'm a sleepy guying, and the idea of your life passing you by and the idea of somebody, you know, living on borrowed time every day in a finite mortal body and, you know, the idea of like every second being critical to you moving forward, accomplishing things, and then watching all of that time just be wiped off the clock because of this thing that happened to you that nobody can explain. And we'll talk about that more later, but I just wanted to begin the thread of that. Reports of a mysterious illness matching this description had been surfacing throughout Eastern Europe for at least a year. However, no one was sure what to make of these cases or if they were even connected. Furthermore, non-essential news spread slowly as Europe was in the midst of World War I and all sides were experiencing mass casualties at an unprecedented rate. Unbeknownst to medical professionals, the sickness had grown into a full-blown epidemic by the time it reached Dr. Economo in Vienna. With an abundance of cases in his hands, Economo became the first person to classify the sickness as a single disease in 1917, after finding small inflammatory lesions in the mid and lower parts of the brain of those who died. He dubbed the medical mystery encephalitis lethargica. Encephalitis meaning inflammation of the brain, and lethargica referring to its primary symptom, sleepiness. There's also another aspect of this, which is like, it's one of those stories where in reality, it's not funny.
It's tragic.
This is kind of a dark cuts. Like, when we read more about this, like, it's not funny. It's very sad. But on the surface level, It's a bunch of really sleepy people.
A sleeple, if you will.
Who are medically sleepy, who were assessed by dozens of scientists, and they diagnosed them as sleepy. And that's kind of funny. Aesthetically, it's funny. But it's not actually funny. It's very sad. Despite the disease expressing itself differently in every victim, Economo was able to classify the illness further into three general sets of symptoms.
The somnolent ophthalmoplegic form was by far the most common, characterized by a sickly delirium accompanied by the inescapable desire to sleep for abnormally long periods of time. Economo also noted that these patients would be woken and sometimes were able to recall much of what had occurred during the times that they were seemingly asleep. Despite being the deadliest form with a mortality rate greater than 50%, survivors were much less likely to experience lasting effects. The hyperkinetic form was characterized by an initial bout of mania, accompanied by involuntary movements and vocalizations. The manic phase was followed by a general restlessness, weakness, and fatigue. These patients also suffered from visual and tactile hallucinations and had a reverse daylight sleep cycle. The amyostatic akinetic form was the rarest, characterized by a general stiffness and struggle with movement, though when nurses moved their limbs, they moved easily, suggesting that the inability to move was a problem with the brain's communication with the body. These patients seemed less cognitively impaired by their lethargy, but curiously struggled to show any emotions on their faces.
So just to break it down, just to kind of differentiate this and kind of be like, how is this any more novel or interesting than these people were all in like a coma, which is not a common thing, but it's a thing that we're commonly aware of. And people go into comas for a variety of reasons. And then there's medically induced comas and things like that. So basically these people, they had these lesions on their brain tissue, which nobody really understood where they came from or why. And something about these lesions were causing them to be so tired. And I'm sure everybody's experienced that, like not the type of tired that you are at night whenever you've been up all day and you get really tired and you want to go to bed and you go to sleep, but rather when it's like in the middle of the day sometimes and you're just sitting, you know, somewhere, maybe you're like hanging out with friends, sitting around talking, or you're, you know, watching TV on the couch or something where you're like not up and about. And despite your best efforts, you just become really tired and you try to stay awake and then you just can't fight it and you kind of drift off. Rather than like the tiredness of going to sleep at night after a full day, it's just that lethargic feeling that you sometimes get in the middle of the day for whatever reason. And some people experience it worse than others and they have chronic fatigue where they constantly feel tired like that and they have to have medical intervention to fix that. So these people had such chronic fatigue that they actually would just go to sleep and stay asleep and you could rouse them and wake them up. It would be like waking somebody up in the middle of the night and they're like half there. You can tell that they're not fully understanding what you're saying. And you're telling them something and they're just like, yeah, I know. But you know that they just aren't hearing what you're saying. And you could do that to these people. And also they would, you know, respond to you asking them to do things in the way that you can with a person in the middle of the night. When my sons are asleep at 2 a.m, I can get them and be like, come on, move in here. We got to go to this other bedroom. And they'll do it. They'll get up and they'll walk. But they're asleep still. They're not fully awake. And it was basically like that. So it wasn't a coma. It was just like they were just so tired that they could not wake up from being normally asleep. And this was hundreds upon eventually thousands upon eventually millions of people across the world that just out of nowhere in 1917 into the early 1920s just all experienced these same symptoms simultaneously and went to sleep. In 1918, a year after EL was officially described by Economo, Francis Graham Cruikshank, a British epidemiologist, pointed out that several seemingly similar events have taken place in history before. Can you imagine if in 2020, instead of his name being Dr. Anthony Fauci, his name was Dr. Anthony Cruikshank?
I would have been so fucking amped on that.
But can you imagine the field day that some people would have had with that if his name was Cruikshank?
Yeah, they were like, he's crooked! He's crooked!
Yeah, I mean, they had to make do with, like, taking Fauci and, like, turning that into weird, like, reaches of puns. Like, oh, it's Dr. Fake-she and things like that. But if they were handed Cruikshank on a fucking silver platter, Jesus Christ. That's the darkest timeline.
That we would have had to deal with so many shitty puns.
Yeah, not much darker than this one, but slightly darker. Despite this, no one was any closer to understanding what was actually causing the disease or how it was transmitted. Dr. Economo ruled out toxins, typhoid, polio, and syphilis as causes of the disease. Though it was largely considered to be the reaction to an unknown infection, whether viral or bacterial, no one was sure. Also on that note, Dr. Economo, that's like a scientist from a science fiction film from the 1950s. Like, if Dr. Fauci had been Dr. Economo, we'd be living in a utopia right now.
Do you think when people, like during the late teens and early 20s, when people were going to sleep and they were like really fatigued, do you think that people in the social orbit of individuals that had been infected with the sleeping disease had like dismissive pet names for them? Like, they just called them like fatigues or teegies because they were just like, you're fucking sleepy, bro. All right, bro, I'm out here fucking stimulating the economy, working. You're just in here just being a teegie, fucking taking your little nippy naps.
Yeah, there definitely was like people who were just like, these fucking sleepy guys that are taking up all the resources. My taxes are going to a sleepy guy?
All these fucking guys out here being just sleepy? I don't think so.
I pulled myself up by my bootstraps this morning, and there's a sleepy guy who's still in bed right now, hogging up my money, my tax dollar. I mean, there definitely was people like that that was just like, oh, we should just kill these people for sure. Further, the profound sleepiness is generally considered an immune response to the disease, while neurological issues such as the twitches and spasms are attributed to the damage inflicted on the brain. So that's an interesting distinction, that it wasn't that like this disease caused sleepiness, but rather that it seemed like this disease actually caused like chronic spasms of the body, issues with speech, neurological problems, memory problems, so on and so forth. And it was actually the body's immune response to make the person just go to sleep. Around this same time, the Spanish flu began ravaging the world, and many wondered if the two could be linked, though this connection is still debated to this day. The interesting thing there is, so as I said before, this whole thing was overshadowed by the fact that it kind of happened alongside or concurrently to the Spanish flu. And so people just don't remember this thing where, like, as we'll talk about later, a million people died. But one might reasonably assume, because it was happening alongside of the Spanish flu, and because it was so novel and unprecedented, and because it was never explained or nobody ever discovered the reason for it, you know, the natural inclination is to say it's probably something related to the Spanish flu, right? It's probably the same thing. It's probably some kind of, you know, like there's COVID and then there's long COVID, and the effects that are associated with long COVID that are very different than the actual direct infectious results of getting COVID. But people have never been able to definitively link the two. There's no definitive answer on whether they were related at all. A year later, in 1919, the epidemic reached American shores. Now popularly dubbed, quote, sleeping sickness, news of the mystery spread faster as World War I had ended, and the world now lived in fear of two concurrent epidemics. The New York Times read,
"Fears sleeping sickness, Dr. Copeland tells, the appearance of a rare disease, March 11th, 1919. Sleeping sickness in Washington, March 15th, 1919. 40 coma cases here. Second death from encephalitis reported by Health Bureau, March 6, 1919. Sleeping sickness kills 14. Surgeon General Blue to investigate spread of malady, April 6, 1919. Child slept for a month. New York hospitals, fifth case of odd malady cured, April 16, 1919.
Twitter livestream of Marjorie Taylor Greene unearthed, showing her claiming that the sleeping sickness is caused by a Jewish Sandman. Despite what the last headline may have you believe, no one was cured of the sickness. Rather, their bodies just so happened to be able to break out of the sleep which trapped them. Sleeping sickness continued to spread unhindered for nearly a decade with no perceivable rhyme or reason as to who could wake up and when. Further, a new phase of the disease made itself abundantly clear by the later years of the epidemic. The quote, chronic phase of the disease typically occurred 1 to 5 years after the patient's first bout of prolonged sleep, though some patients became chronic before ever having woken up. The chronic phase was characterized by Parkinsonism, involuntary movements, and speech abnormalities. These patients also fell into varying states of catatonia, once again immobile in their own bodies and largely unable to communicate. For years on end, these patients showed no progress. Families struggled to know how to proceed, and slowly but surely, survivors affected by the chronic stage were placed in mental hospitals, nursing homes, and chronic care facilities. So, you know, there's this initial phase of this mysterious disease or syndrome that crops up, and all these people are being affected, you know, millions of people across the world.
And there's all these doctors kind of looking into it and studying these people and trying to figure it out. And then, you know, as the condition progresses and we get into like the early 20s, you know, 1921, 22, 23, people start to kind of move on from it in the way that, you know, drawing a parallel, there's a point in which people kind of started moving on from COVID. Like there was a time whenever it was like the number one thing that everybody talked about all day, every day. And then there was the time where people were like, oh, it's over. And then there was a time when people were talking about the variants and it was like, oh no, it's back. And then there was like this slow meandering crawl towards people just kind of like mostly being like, eh, that's not a thing anymore. And in that vacuum, you know, there's a lot of people that are still affected by it, whether they're, you know, new cases of COVID that happen still and people, you know, still deal with that on an individual basis, or people who have been afflicted with long COVID symptoms long term that are still, you know, dealing with that. And some of those are mild and some of those are very severe. Some people are afflicted by really bad disabilities from it. But people have mostly just kind of like as a culture, we've moved on from it, which I'm not saying that is a good thing. It just is what it is. But this is the period where that's happened here, where all these people this happened to, but they never really figured out why or how to cure them. And eventually, you know, what little public was sort of invested in the story, as well as the medical community, just kind of lost interest in it. And then these people just kind of became wards of the state, essentially. A lot of them died. I think, as we'll talk about in a second, like up to 1 million people died. And the rest of them just kind of stayed asleep and stayed in these like nursing homes and psychiatric wards across the world. They kind of became lost to time, which is doubly sad considering the actual effects or the symptoms of it. They're completely forgotten about and lost to time. And they're also just lost to consciousness and reality. They're just like somewhere asleep and nobody's thinking of them. It's almost like, you know, you say like a man dies twice, when they actually die and then when they're forgotten about. Like these people experienced those two deaths simultaneously without actually dying. They were removed from the world and then people forgot about them, essentially. Research on the still mysterious sickness had lasted throughout the 20s and 30s, but dropped off entirely by the start of World War II. Though sleeping sickness is estimated to have affected up to 5 million and killed up to 1 million, these numbers were both dwarfed by the Spanish flu's estimated 500 million cases and 25 million deaths in the span of 2 years. Yeah, I said 32 million earlier, but it was 25. I don't know where I got that 32 number. Thus, sleeping sickness quickly faded from historical memory and became known as the forgotten epidemic. Its few remaining survivors, confined to various care facilities, were similarly forgotten to the medical world and our collective consciousness. Born in 1933, Oliver Wolfe Sacks was the youngest child of two English physicians. His mother was one of the first female surgeons in England, and his father was a neurologist who practiced medicine into his late 90s. Oliver, following in their footsteps, studied medicine at the Queen's College at Oxford University and promptly moved to Canada, where he worked as a logger and roamed on his motorcycle before moving to California, where he became a state champion weightlifter.
Is this guy Doc Savage?
He's Doc Savage. He's Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, for real.
He's a brain surgeon, logger, motorcycle wanderer, weightlifter champion.
This is fucked up. This is fucked up. I shouldn't be this excited about like a dude. I mean, I guess I should, because, you know, never mind. I'm going to rescind that. It's a sad story, but I'm very excited about this guy.
Yeah, Dr. Oliver Sacks, real life Doc Savage. Eventually, however, Oliver became disillusioned with his path and moved to New York, where he accepted a job at the Beth Abraham Hospital in 1966. It was here where Dr. Sacks encountered patients unlike anything he had ever seen in any of the psychiatric wards he had worked in before. Patients who spent the entirety of their waking hours frozen like statues in strange positions. Patients who he learned had been like this, within these walls, for 30 to 40 years. Patients who were suffering from the chronic phase of encephalitis lethargica.
The notion that that all of us live in the same world, and that distance and duration and the feel of things and the appearance of things is something constant. This was absolutely shattered, and I would say it was shattered in a flash by seeing these people who obviously lived in a way in extremely distorted worlds, and often fantastically distorted worlds, with all the distortions which one finds in Alice. It was very much an Alice-like wonderland.
So this is our boy, the real-life Doc Savage, Dr. Oliver Sacks. And honestly, he kind of looks like me.
Yeah, he does kind of look like you, but he needs an eye patch, though.
I was going to do like a Dr. Oliver Sacks looks like, but he kind of looks like me with like a really full beard that I'm not capable of growing. But also it's so full and also so manicured that it looks fake.
Yeah, that looks like he went to the barber and was like, can you just put AstroTurf on my face?
Just make me look like I'm in that show Lazy Town or the giant toy Santa Claus from Santa Claus 2, the one that they make to like work in his place while he goes back to the regular world and tries to find a wife. And he's got that plastic beard. That's what it looks like. The patients Sacks encountered were all trapped in varying states of catatonia. Some could be spoken to and accomplish basic tasks or movements, though in an extremely slow and compromised manner. And others had almost no reaction to any stimulus. These patients spent their waking hours nearly indistinguishable from their sleeping ones, aside from the presence of sudden and strange movements and contortions. In reference to meeting these patients, Sacks stated,
"One wondered at first what was going on inside these people, if they had an inside."
That phrasing really struck me. That was like a disturbing way of saying that whenever I was reading this, to wonder if they had an inside. That's just such a Lovecraftian way of describing that.
Yeah, for real.
This wonder remained unresolved until one day, Sacks witnessed a patient experience a sudden and violent sneeze, the shock of which broke the man out of his catatonia. For a few brief moments, the man looked around under his own accord and spoke freely before suddenly glazing over and returning to his statue-like state.
But in that 30 seconds, a whole personality and something of a human life had been revealed,
Sacks recalled. And honestly, that is the power of a dad scream sneeze.
I know you mean the like,
That's why we do it. Every dad, once you become a dad, there are two things that you are sort of overtaken with, almost like a werewolf-esque transformation. One of them is making dad jokes, and the other one is scream sneezing. And the scream sneezing, its scientific function is to keep us awake and alert and alive so that we can protect our, you know, whatever you call it, our little enclave.
Brood?
Yes, our brood.
You didn't scream sneeze prior to having children?
No, prior to kids, it was like, Phew! After kids, But you didn't even hear that. It was so loud. It was so screamed that Zoom edited it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's what happened. It's the literal definition of staying woke. And here it is, saving people again. The scream sneeze. It's underrated. And also, if you notice, I just made a dad joke just then. So I'm like full dad right now. My kids must be like hiding somewhere and I'm detecting them with my dad sense and I don't realize it. Now profoundly fascinated and fully invested in helping these people, Sacks had as many chronic EL patients as he could moved into the same ward for further study. He monitored them closely, conducting daily group physical therapy sessions and attempting to build a sense of community within a group of people many considered lost causes. Also, one thing about this, which is something we got to talk about, and I could be wrong, like I don't know the full spectrum of this guy's life and other things that he was involved with. And I also don't know like the full details of his involvement even with this. I only really know what has been said, you know, in this documentary that was made about this in the 1970s and, you know, articles about it and so on and so forth. But, you know, this is happening during the 1960s, right? And we've covered stories about scientists and doctors during the period of the 1950s, the 1960s, and the 1970s. And there's also many other ones that we, you know, are aware of. And this is true throughout history, even up to today. But especially during this time period, for whatever reason, it was ripe with people recognizing vulnerable communities of people afflicted with certain medical or social maladies, people with diseases, or poor people, or people that just didn't have family. And this especially becomes true leading into World War II, obviously, with, you know, the Nazi experiments on Jewish people and the Japanese medical experiments. But people that just took advantage of these situations to conduct acts of just horrific human cruelty and just like crimes against humanity in the name of medical progress, like testing torture techniques and different medical treatments on people that would oftentimes kill them or put them in a tremendous amount of pain over a prolonged series of time in order to conduct studies and create notes and research that were then utilized for scientific and medical advancement. And a lot of the medical benefits that we enjoy today were built on the backs of this horrific torture and murder, essentially. And we've talked about stuff like the MK Ultra experiments that they did and a few other things like that. In this specific case, this seems to be an outlier in that Dr. Oliver Sacks stumbled across this community of people with this medical affliction. He was the first person to discover these people in decades. And you took a look at what was happening with them, and seemingly, instead of being like, oh my God, this is my opportunity to conduct a bunch of research and like figure out some scientific shit and just like experiment on these people, he was overcome with a profound sense of wanting to help these people specifically. He didn't see it as an opportunity to like gain medical knowledge and to apply in the future. He just wanted to help these people, and he dedicated his life for the next several years to just trying to help these people wake up, which is not common, I don't think, for this time period.
Not common for today. Like, I still feel like, you know, there's a lot of, this isn't me being anti-doctor or anti-science. I'm just saying we live in a fucking capitalist country and money rules everything, and caring for patients is a very profitable game. Curing diseases, not always as profitable. And so that makes me a little cynical sometimes in contexts like these. Whereas this situation was literally just, I'm going to fucking figure this shit out, dude.
Yeah. And like I said, I could be wrong. There's always the ulterior, potential ulterior motive of wanting fame and recognition for doing something. Obviously, that's like, you can't unmarry anything from that, really. You can make an argument that any act done by anybody is selfish in that way. And there could be something else that I'm just missing, that he secretly was doing it because of this. But as far as I can tell, he just genuinely wanted to help them wake up without any desire of using them for research or gaining fame for some kind of technique that he developed or anything like that. He just saw these people and was just like, I gotta fix this shit. The real life Doc Savage. That's something he would do. Mega Chad, Dr. Oliver Sacks. Fuck that. Giga Chad. Sacks also recorded everything on his home video camera in hopes of tracking any potential progress made by the patients. Though physical therapy brought about negligible improvements, Sacks and his team immediately noticed remarkable instances of life within the patients, such as individuals who could barely move under their own accord being able to catch a ball if tossed to them. Nonetheless, little progress was made until the summer of 1969, when Sacks, having long recognized that many of the symptoms his patients experienced were similar to Parkinson's disease, decided to try using a new drug which showed promising results amongst Parkinson's patients. The new drug was L-DOPA, which put simply is a form of dopamine able to cross the blood-brain barrier and stimulate deteriorating receptors within the substantia nigra, a part of the brain involved in motivation and movement. To everyone's amazement, the L-DOPA not only helped, but seemingly worked miracles. Almost every patient experienced a miraculous awakening, a return to health, and a return to life. Sacks recalled,
"The effects of this were incredible. Within a week, in some patients even less, they came to."
And this was the real catalyzing detail that made me want to do this story, to cover this story for the show, because there aren't many examples that I know of something like this happening. There were a group of people, dwindling numbers over the years, because many of them died, frankly, but a group of people who essentially fell asleep in 1920, and then they stayed asleep until 1969, right? And then a doctor kind of noticed it, and he looked into it and started kind of monitoring them. And then this drug came around that was meant for people with Parkinson's, which this disease is apparently closely related to. And he gave them the drug, and after 50 years of being asleep, they just woke up and were just like, oh shit, what happened? What'd I miss? Like, that's crazy.
It's a nightmare scenario. It's a full-on nightmare scenario.
It's totally a nightmare. And we tagged this at the beginning, and we're going to talk about that more. This idea of going to sleep when you're 17 and waking up when you're 65.
They awakened. Their frozen faces melted. Their smiles appeared. Eyes started to look around and get bright and twinkle. Unused voices appeared. unused muscles started to work. It was certainly a very festive feeling.
Lola, one of the first patients to receive L-DOPA, had been catatonic for decades and had recently lost the ability to swallow. She was given L-DOPA in an attempt to keep her alive, yet within seconds, she was able to stand and hold conversations. Sachs later stated,
"I would doubt my own memory were it not supported by everyone else's memory."
Other patients who were deemed terminal were able to walk on their own again after just 3 weeks on L-DOPA.
Yeah, like, that's just staggering to me. The idea that, like, this woman was so far gone that she was on the verge of dying. Like, she was in the final stages of her body shutting down. She couldn't swallow anymore, so she couldn't eat. And then they gave her this, and then she was just, like, popped up, and she was like, "What up?" That's staggering to me. I can't even fathom that.
As more and more patients came to, long-standing questions regarding their varying degrees of catatonia came to light. While some patients expressed that they had been fully aware of their situations for decades and simply could not do anything about it, other patients stated that they were aware of some things, but none of it felt real. So some of these people were basically just catatonic, like they were aware of what was going on around them and they just really couldn't engage with their surroundings, kind of similar to some extreme medical conditions that leave you sort of in a unresponsive, nonverbal, or catatonic state for an indefinite amount of time or your entire life. Some of the people basically experienced the world like it was like a dream, like in that way that sometimes you, when you wake up and you're not quite awake yet, and then something happens and you kind of interpret it through your dream lens, and it gets like ingested into the dream you're having, and they would experience it like that. And then some people just literally went to sleep in 1920 and woke up in 1969. Which one of those do you think would be worse?
I mean, I've said it. Waking up again is the worst scenario.
But I mean, the difference between going into a trance-like catatonic state where you're just aware of your surroundings, but you can't talk or move, and being like that for 50 years. I mean, I think the answer is kind of obvious, but being like that for 50 years, going into a dreamlike state where everything around you seems like it's a surreal dream, and being like that for 50 years, or going to sleep, being asleep for 50 years and waking up.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You're right. It's the catatonic state, but you're still aware of everything that's going on around you. Like, that's a fucking nightmare. Like, I guess you just hope to go to sleep and never wake up.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's the obvious choice of the thing that's worse. But the greater long-term implications, like in the moment, being in a catatonic state for 50 years, being trapped inside of your own body, like, hands down, that's the worst one. But then once you wake up, after you're awake already, then which one becomes worse? Because in one case, you are aware of the passage of time. And while it was probably an utter nightmare to live in that experience, you're up to date. You understand what's happened. Whereas somebody who just like went to sleep as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kid with their entire world ahead of them and then woke up in their 60s. With really no hope of any kind of functional life moving forward because all of their social ties have been severed. They haven't built anything resembling a social or professional life for themselves. It's just all gone in a blink of an eye. So then once you've woken up, then it's not as clear which one is the worst one, I don't think. It's a little bit more like, I don't know, which one would I have wanted in retrospect?
I mean, it's still a nightmare scenario to wake up having slept for 50 years, but being completely cognizant and being in the prison of your own body is like enough to make you go insane. Like, it fundamentally warps who you are and shapes everything about you.
Yeah, it would just be horrific. I don't even want to imagine. Further, a patient named Sylvia awoke with a particularly 1920 speech pattern and only referenced things that had happened before she fell asleep nearly 40 years prior. Sylvia could even recall a plethora of songs from her youth and soon gained a reputation for spending her days singing in her room. Throughout the summer, as patients regained their lives one by one, the hospital's routines were quickly shattered, as patients simply wanted to have fun and do things. Patients played the piano, sang, and danced together in lieu of physical therapy. Sachs, still mesmerized by the events unfolding in front of him, obliged and spent weeks filming the group and learning their story, stating,
"There seemed a real possibility that they might not only come to life again, but perhaps be able to lead full lives."
During this period, however, it soon became clear that transitioning back into a waking life was harsher than any of them could have even fathomed. Countless loved ones had died, careers had been ruined, and they all had to come to terms with the fact that they were now elderly, their bodies weak, and their best years lost to time. Sachs stated that Lola, having been the fulcrum which held her family together, took the realization that her family had fallen apart in her absence particularly harshly. Her husband and daughter had fallen into extreme depression and her son had vanished. Lola carried an intense sadness and guilt from there on out. Similarly, after a mere 10 days of being joyfully stuck in the tens, a sort of horror came over Sylvia as she came to terms with the true nature of the time that had elapsed. Even though these patients had regained a footprint on this earth, they remained in a sort of limbo, disconnected from their former selves, their families, and the ongoings of the world. This is what I kind of set up earlier in the episode. So, you know, the headline clickbait story of this is these people went to sleep in the 1920s, and then due to this miracle medicine, they were all woken up in 1969. And it was like, holy shit, like, we fixed this problem and now you guys are all awake. The deeper, more nuanced, kind of obvious when you think about it for a little bit, details of it are people who went to sleep as young adults, because any of the people who fell into, you know, this sleep sickness who were adults, they're long dead by now. So all these people who are still alive in the late 60s, early 70s, they were teenagers whenever this happened. So the logical conclusion of something like this is a group of people who went to sleep whenever they were teenagers and woke up when they were elderly people. And everything that that implies, the loss of 40 to 50 years worth of life, the loss of their family who inevitably either died or moved on if it was a husband or wife or whatever. I guess it wouldn't be a husband or wife because they were teenagers, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, but people got married at like 18 at that point. So, you know, it could be.
Whether it was spouses or just family who moved on because, you know, they thought you were essentially dead. Just lack of any like social capital, essentially. You haven't created a career. You haven't made any connections in the world. From a societal perspective, you're still a child. So it's people waking up, and at first in the euphoria of like, I'm awake, I'm alive, I have this clarity for the first time in many decades. But they started to come to grips with the reality of the situation and realized just the profound level of loss that they experienced. A level of loss that's almost impossible for a person to fathom. It's more loss than I think most people could physically suffer. And so they all just descended into a horrible dark depression, which I absolutely would as well. And this is what I was setting up, is like, this is that nightmare taken to its just absolute extreme. The idea of, number one, just in your own life, not even talking about creative aspirations, but just your life as a person, but then also folding in, you know, aspirations, things that you want to accomplish. And this idea of grappling with time and grappling with consciousness and fighting for every last little second, every last little moment of time that you can be awake and moving forward and doing these things and accomplishing your goals and what you want to do, and always feeling like there's a clock running out for you and having that looming over your head. And these people all woke up one day and realized that that was all just taken away from them forcefully. Like, they didn't even have a chance to fight against it. It was just gone.
Well, here's the other component of this that we're not talking about, the kind of elephant in the room, if you will. These people all went to sleep at like 15, 16, 17, and now they're like 65. Which is basically the plot of an anime, because now they're old people that are all sexually attracted to minors.
Oh, yeah. They're all pedophiles.
They're all pedophiles.
Yes. Pedophilia in absentia is the medical definition of it. That's true, though. I mean, it's funny and dark simultaneously. But also, like, it really is true. Like, there's no way that you go to sleep as a 15-year-old and then you wake up as a 65-year-old and you want to fuck a 65-year-old. Like, that's not ageist. It's just like, you were a 15-year-old.
Yeah, mentally, you're a 15-year-old. Yeah. Can you picture this court case where Robert De Niro is like, Your Honor, I don't know. The age of consent is, I don't know. You know, I was just here. I was sleeping. And she looked at me and I was like, how you doing? I don't know.
The B plot that they cut out of that movie for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
It's true, though. I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right. Like, they were all pedophiles. It's true. I don't want it to be true, but it's true.
That would be so fucked up. Like, yeah. That would be so fucked up to be in that position.
You know, people say life isn't fair. And like, that's a thing that we're all aware of as a thing. Like, that's the ultimate answer to anything, is life isn't fair. And I kind of feel like to a certain degree that's kind of bullshit. Like, life isn't fair is a permission structure to just fuck people over and just be like, that's just how it is. But this is actually the definition of life isn't fair. This is where the idea of life not being fair actually applies. Because these people, their lives are just ruined and shattered. All this time has been taken away from them. There's no way of going back and reclaiming it. You're fucked. Most people get to live a good 60, 70, 80 years and do what they need to do with that time. And whatever you do with that time is kind of on you. And whatever you accomplish, that's kind of your own thing. But you get that 60, 70, 80 years. Probably, you know, at this time it was a little lower than 80, but now it's like, you know, like 85 years, 100 if you're lucky. But you guys, you don't get any of that. You get like 20 years, 25, that's it. And also you don't even really get that because most of your life, you know, now that you've woken up, you're not going to go out there and tackle the world with aplomb, you know, like you're just going to hang out in a medical facility and try to recuperate physically for probably the rest of your life. You got that 15 years originally, and that's kind of it. And, you know, sorry, most people get that, but you don't. And also, like, you're a pedophile? That's so unfair. It's not their fault. It's not their fault. Man, you added some dimensions to that. I didn't think about that. By the early days of autumn, the mood had shifted. Patients began regressing. Nightmares and long-forgotten symptoms reemerged. Yet this time, the tics and tremors were accompanied by fits of rage, hallucinations, and a complete inability to regulate emotions. Sachs frantically attempted to adjust dosages, but nothing seemed to be working. Slowly, patients lost their abilities to walk and talk once more. Sachs was faced with the horror that his experiment had snatched away their lives just as quickly as it gave them back. Their spectacular recoveries were equaled by truly disastrous deterioration. For many patients, the events had undoubtedly left them worse off. Sachs stated,
"Too many threads had been broken."
Both referring to their mental ability to come to terms with the time lost to illness, and their brain's physical ability to recover from decades of deterioration. Just as the symptoms of chronic EF varied wildly from patient to patient, their reactions to the long-term use of L-DOPA made the treatment a gamble. In the end, a small portion of patients were able to stay on L-DOPA at a dosage which allowed the brains to regulate into a middle ground, where it granted them more ability than without it. Lola, having experienced a particularly harsh relapse, was able to regain her speech for a second time after her dosage was adjusted. However, she remained unable to regulate her mood as the flood of dopamine had affected other parts of her brain. For others, the ability to speak again, no matter how slow or compromised, was enough to reconnect with family and make continued treatment of L-DOPA worth it. Sachs has also expressed a sense of trauma and guilt over the experience, wondering if he had awoken all these people just to submit them to a state of torment worse than their previous conditions. Nonetheless, the patients who could still communicate encouraged Sachs to assemble their stories and his notes into a book, ensuring that their lives would fade into obscurity once more. Over 100 years have passed since sleeping sickness first spread across the world, and we still have little to no idea what actually caused it, nor how it could be prevented if it ever reemerged. Its survivors have all since perished, doomed to slip through the cracks of history. That is, of course, except for a small few who sang and danced for Oliver Sacks' home video camera, proudly demonstrating their presence, stuck out of time. These relics of the past experienced unimaginable horrors, stuck in states of delirium for damn near a lifetime, yet they remained utterly ecstatic for weeks on end when they had a second chance to experience unrestrained consciousness. During their brief glimpse at what could have been a normal life, a patient named Leonard wrote,
"I am a living candle. I am consumed so that you may learn. New things will be seen in the light of my suffering." Ugh.
Though much remains a mystery regarding this sickness, the struggles of its victims have taught us much about the brain chemistry responsible for translating will into action, how illness can affect these processes, and the risks of experimental drugs on the brain. First of all, that patient Leonard was a fucking poet. That's some dark, profound shit that he said. Like, goddamn. There's a couple of things here. Well, first of all, you know, this is our story, sleeping sickness, these people who were just very unfortunately afflicted with this condition out of nowhere, just seemed to be kind of like luck of the draw, essentially, which led them to kind of have a pretty tragic life, which had this event that happened in the late 1960s where they were roused out of this only to kind of recede back into the fog because of a combination of the fact that the medication just wasn't able to regulate it well enough, and also just probably some psychological backpedaling due to the just insane psychic trauma and depression that they were experiencing from realizing the implications of what had happened. So that being said, what are your final thoughts on this, Dave?
My final thoughts are I am not strong enough to survive this. I don't think I would survive it. Like, I think I'm a pretty mentally resilient person. Nah, I wouldn't live through this.
So you're saying that in the event that you were to recede into a prolonged bout of indefinite sleeping, me as, of course, your sole conservator, ward of your estate, and the person that essentially has the hand on the plug, you would say to me that I should pull it?
I would say I will not survive this one way or the other. Whether that's you or just coming out of this, I don't know. I don't think I could survive it. Could you?
Definitely not. But you're saying in the event of this, I take the pillow and I...
Full on $1 million baby style. Million dollar baby.
I don't know if I could do it. I feel like I would always hold out hope that we could... Like, I would have hope that we could invent some kind of like de-aging ray that could reduce you back to your simultaneous 12-year-old and also 80-year-old self. I don't know if I could do it. I don't know if I could pull the plug.
Maybe it's time that I enlist Hilsmer.
You'd pull the plug immediately. You wouldn't even give anyone a chance to like... talk about it.
It's like you took a nap and I'd be like, fuck
yeah.
It, kill him.
Yeah, I would just be like, he never takes naps. He must have gone into a coma. Pull the plug. And I would just wake up in the middle of it and be like, what are you doing, Dave? That's my iPhone. It's charging. I wanted to charge it while I was sleeping. And you're just like, nothing. I wasn't trying to kill you.
What about you? What are your final thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, this is one of those stories that butts up against a lot of different ethical concepts in a way that isn't clean. And it kind of gives you pause to think about exactly where your ethical lines are drawn in ways that you're not usually forced to confront. I feel like a lot of our beliefs and our worldviews, they have blurry outer edges that we never need to explore, and we don't need to actually draw the line of where this ends and that begins. And stories like this are those moments that cause you to have to realize where the line is, because there's a couple of different things here. I mean, number one, Oliver Sacks, real life Doc Savage, he's a bit of a tragic figure, right? He discovered these people and he developed this sense of empathy towards them and he wanted to help them. And it seemed like he was solely devoted to helping these specific people, not using them as an experiment to develop a drug to help people in the future. He wanted to help these people. And I don't know if he really got much out of that situation. Not that he should have or that he wanted to, but he didn't really get much out of this experience other than trying to help the people.
Well, he did get a book and a movie deal.
And like I said before, that, you know, there's always that ulterior motive of acquisition of fame and notoriety.
But I don't get the sense that that's why he did it. I feel like that came with success.
So he wanted to help these people, and you know, by all metrics, it seemed like he just failed. But not only did he fail, like it would be better if he failed, actually. It would be better if he tried to help them and it just didn't work. But he did help them, and then in the end, the help wasn't good enough, and it actually made things worse for a lot of them. And that's a tragic thing. I can't even imagine that, of like not only not being able to help these people, but also maybe in my attempt to help them, like I actually maybe made things worse and contributed to like a worse existence for them. Like that's very fucked up. But also it gets into this discussion of, you know, there's a constellation here of different concepts. Number one, there's this idea of assisted or medical suicide, right? Where some people are experiencing a condition or a mode of life that is so unbearable to them that they want to die. And there's a lot of debate about that. Medically assisted suicide is illegal in the United States. It's not illegal in Canada. And in fact, it's just kind of a function of the medical system. You can use your medical insurance to have somebody kill you in Canada, almost to the overstepping, honestly. Like there's some stuff I've read about the medical system in Canada where, like, you know, they'll have these like insane wait times for things. And sometimes, you know, you'll try to seek treatment for some kind of chronic condition and they'll be like, you know, the wait time for you to see somebody about this is like a year. Have you considered killing yourself? Which doesn't seem good. That doesn't seem good to me. So there's a spectrum there, right? There's you're not allowed to do this at all on one end. And a lot of people don't
think that that should be the case. A lot of people think that medically assisted suicide should be legal in the United States and that people should be in control of what they do with their own body and they should be able to end their lives pain-free in a controlled environment as opposed to having to, you know, kill themselves by themselves in a likely very painful way. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where it's like, this is not only legal, but also maybe it's exploited and like overused in the medical system, like a lot of treatments can tend to be in the medical system for profit. So there's that, right? And then there's also this other idea, and this is another thing that's talked with the Canada thing, of like this idea of eugenics, of like if you're disabled, you should just kill yourself because, you know, your life sucks. So you should just kill yourself. And that's eugenics, basically. The idea of creating a system in which people with extremely unique medical conditions and disabilities are encouraged to kill themselves is just like, by definition, you're trying to cull the population of people with disabilities. Like, that's just eugenics. Like I said, there's this spectrum of it where it's like, on one end, should people be allowed to do this whenever they feel personally like things have gotten too bad for them, versus a system that actually encourages disabled people to end their lives, which is this idea that disabled people are not real people, they're not valid people, and they don't belong in the world, and so they should therefore remove themselves from the world, and framing it as if you're helping them, but in reality, it's just eugenics. And then in this situation, you have a situation where these people were subjected to a life circumstance that is almost cosmically horrifying, right? Like you just said, you couldn't handle this. You couldn't survive this. I couldn't. I don't want to go to sleep now and wake up when I'm 70 and realize that my whole life passed me by and I missed my kids growing up and I didn't accomplish any of the goals that I had set for myself in those 50 years. Well, me turning 65 is not in 50 years. I'm a little older than these teenagers, but you know what I mean? I don't want to do that. And it would be profoundly, unimaginably horrifying to me at an existential level if I woke up one day and I went to sleep at 36 and I woke up and I was 70 or 80 or whatever. Honestly, it would be fucking horrifying to me if I woke up in 3 years, losing 3 years. That would be incredibly depressing to me. I'm unpacking a lot, so I'm hoping you're still following me. But basically, we have this situation where you have, maybe it was better if these people just didn't wake up.
Is that better? I don't know. I mean, obviously the trauma sucks, but like, isn't cognizance and consciousness better than non-consciousness, even if it is painful?
Let me reframe that. Not is this better, but would these people have opted to wake up, or would they have rather just drifted off into oblivion and died? So you have that of like, what Oliver Sacks tried to do in many cases actually ended up kind of being a disservice to them. It actually made their situation worse. Would they have opted to not wake up if given the choice? But they couldn't be given the choice because they weren't awake. So you can't get the consent of somebody to, you know, metaphorically pull the plug. It creates this really blurry gray area where it's like, what, you know, what would have been the best situation here for these people?
Well, especially because initially it was like almost discovered by accident that it had this effect. And it's like, of course we should try it on these other people. You know, it seems like the logical thing to do.
It feels like one of those morality plays in like Star Trek or something like that, where somebody thought that doing this thing was going to help this race of aliens or whatever. That's a little bit regressive to compared to aliens, but
yeah, I know what you mean though.
And then they learn this lesson of like, maybe we just shouldn't have interfered at all. And that's what I was just talking about with like this place in the blurriness of your ethical worldview. This makes you have to define the line between two different beliefs that butt up against each other that you've never necessarily interrogated that intersection before. Because I don't believe that disabled people should be encouraged to kill themselves. I think that's awful. I think that's just so existentially offensive to create a paradigm where people are given the option and even encouraged to remove themselves from life because they're suffering from a disability. But I also think that people should be able to make their own choices for their own bodies. And this is where those two things have to come up against each other. And I don't know where this falls on that for me.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
This has been Deep Cuts. You can find me on the internet at heydavebaker.com. Please go check out my book, Mary Tyler Moorhawk. It's around. It's like House of Leaves meets Johnny Quest. You know, novel, graphic novel, available now wherever books are sold. Spandrew, where can people find you on the internet?
If you want to pay your respects to the dear beloved Papa Pricey, you can go to his website, dapricerights.com, and get his book, Deadbolt AI Private Eye. Once again, you can pick up any of Dave's books. But if you happen to live in the Mid-Wilshire area, call into the Barnes & Noble at the Grove and request them to restock their Dave Baker books. Because I was there this weekend and I looked for some Dave books and they didn't have any. So we need to get them. We need to get them back in stock over there, baby. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can go to Facebook and search Deep Cuts Podcast. You can join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group where we talk about the show and make memes and other cool stuff. You can join our Discord server, bit.ly.com/deepcutsdiscord, where we talk about the show, make memes, play games, and other fun stuff. I still owe everybody in the Discord a shout out for the recent accomplishments in the number game, which if you want to know what that means, join the Discord and you'll find out. And you can have your name shouted out on the show if you want. You can follow us on Instagram at deepcutspod. You can follow us on TikTok at Mystery Treehouse. You can follow me on TikTok at deadboydetective, where I make cool videos about facts and other stuff and get criticized by strangers all day. Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.
This episode of Deep Cuts was written by Armand Saheli. If you're interested in writing an episode of Deep Cuts, please email Andrew at boygeniusmedia.com.
The incidental music for this episode was created by D. Catalano, whose music can be found at wekeepoddhours.bandcamp.com.